Chapter 37, 1818. Washington, January 12, 1818. To the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States. The claim of the representatives of the late Caron D. Bulmer case having been recommended to the favorable consideration of the legislature by my predecessor in his message to Congress of the 31st of January last, and concurring in the sentiments therein expressed, I now transmit copies of a new representation relative to it received by the Secretary of State from the Minister of France, and of a correspondence in the subject between the Minister of the United States at Paris and the Duke of Richelieu, enclosed with that representation. James Monroe. To the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States. I have the satisfaction to inform Congress that the establishment at Amelia Island has been suppressed, and without the effusion of blood. The papers which explain this transaction I now lay before Congress. By the suppression of this establishment and of that at Galvestown, which will soon follow, if it has not already ceased to exist, there is good cause to believe that the consummation of a project fraught with much injury to the United States has been prevented. When we consider the persons engaged in it, being adventurers from different countries, with very few, if any, of the native inhabitants of the Spanish colonies, the territory in which the establishments were made, one in a portion of that claimed by the United States westward of the Mississippi, the other in a part of East Florida, a province in negotiation between the United States and Spain, the claim of their leader, as announced by his proclamation in taking possession of Amelia Island, comprising the whole of both the Floridas, without excepting that part of West Florida which is incorporated into the state of Louisiana, their conduct, while in the possession of the island making it instrumental to every species of contraband, and, in regard to slaves, of the most odious and dangerous character, it may fairly be concluded that, if the enterprise had succeeded in the scale in which it was formed, much annoyance and injury would have resulted from it to the United States. Other circumstances were thought to be no less deserving of attention. The institution of a government by foreign adventurers in the island, distinct from the colonial governments of Buenos Aires, Venezuela, or Mexico, pretending to sovereignty and exercising its highest offices, particularly in granting commissions to privateers, were acts which could not fail to draw after them the most serious consequences. It was the duty of the executive either to extend to this establishment all the advantages of that neutrality which the United States had proclaimed, and have observed in favor of the colonies of Spain who, by the strength of their own population and resources, had declared their independence and were affording strong proof of their ability to maintain it, or of making the discrimination which circumstances required. Had the first course been pursued, we should not only have sanctioned all the unlawful claims and practices of this pretended government in regard to the United States, but have countenanced a system of privateering in the Gulf of Mexico and elsewhere, the ill effects of which might, and probably would, have been deeply and very extensively felt. The path of duty was plain from the commencement, but it was painful to enter upon it, while the obligation could be resisted. The law of 1811, lately published, and which it is therefore proper not to mention, was considered applicable to the case from the moment that the proclamation of the chief of the enterprise was seen, and its obligation was daily increased by other considerations of high importance already mentioned, which were deemed sufficiently strong in themselves to dictate the course which has been pursued. Early intimation having been received of the dangerous purposes of these adventurers, timely precautions were taken by the establishment of a force near the St. Mary's to prevent their effect, or it is probable that it would have been more sensibly felt. To such establishments, made so near to our settlements in the expectation of deriving aid from them, it is particularly gratifying to find that very little encouragement was given. The example so conspicuously displayed by our fellow citizens that their sympathies cannot be perverted to improper purposes, but that a love of country, the influence of moral principles, and a respect for the laws are predominant with them, is a sure pledge that all the very flattering anticipations which have been formed of the success of our institutions will be realized. This example has proved that, if our relations with foreign powers are to be changed, it must be done by the constituted authorities, who alone, acting on a high responsibility, are competent to the purpose, and until such change is thus made that our fellow citizens will respect the existing relations by a faithful adherence to the laws which secure them. Believing that this enterprise, though undertaken by persons some of whom may have held commissions from some of the colonies, was unauthorized by and unknown to the colonial governments, full confidence is entertained that it will be disclaimed by them, and that effectual measures will be taken to prevent the abuse of their authority in all cases to the injury of the United States. For these injuries, especially those proceeding from Amelia Island, Spain would be responsible, if it was not manifest that, though committed in the latter instance through her territory, she was utterly unable to prevent them. Her territory, however, ought not to be made instrumental, through her inability to defend it, to purposes so injurious to the United States. To a country over which she fails to maintain her authority, and which she permits to be converted to the annoyance of her neighbors, her jurisdiction for the time necessarily ceases to exist. The territory of Spain will nevertheless be respected so far as it may be done consistently with the essential interests and safety of the United States. In expelling these adventurers from these posts, it was not intended to make any conquest from Spain or to injure in any degree the cause of the colonies. Care will be taken that no part of the territory contemplated by the law of 1811 shall be occupied by a foreign government of any kind, or that injuries of the nature of those complained of shall be repeated, but this, it is expected, will be provided for with every other interest in a spirit of amity in the negotiation now depending with the government of Spain. James Monroe, January 14, 1818. Washington, January 23, 1818. To the House of Representatives of the United States. In compliance with the resolution of the House of Representatives of the 9th of December last, requesting information of what roads have been made or are in progress under the authority of the Executive of the United States, the states and territories through which they passed or are intended to pass, the periods when they were ordered to be made, and how far they have been executed, I now communicate a report from the Secretary of the Treasury, and likewise a report from the Secretary of War, containing the information which is desired. James Monroe, Washington, January 28, 1818. To the Senate of the United States. In compliance with the resolution of the Senate of the 22nd of this month, requesting to be informed in what manner the troops in the service of the United States now operating against the Seminole tribe of Indians have been subsisted, whether by contract or otherwise, and whether they have been furnished regularly with rations, I now transmit a report from the Secretary of War containing the information required. James Monroe, Washington, January 29, 1818. To the House of Representatives of the United States. In compliance with the resolution of the House of Representatives of the 23rd of December last, requesting information relative to the imprisonment and detention in confinement of Richard W. Meade, a citizen of the United States, I now transmit to the House a report from the Secretary of State containing the information required. James Monroe. To the Senate of the United States. In compliance with the resolution of the Senate of the 8th of last month, requesting me to cause to be laid before it the proceedings which may have been had under an act entitled An Act for the Gradual Increase of the Navy of the United States, specifying the number of ships put on the stocks and of what class, the quantity of materials procured for shipbuilding, and also the sums of money which may have been paid out of the fund created by said act, and for what objects, and likewise the contracts which may have been entered into in execution of the act aforesaid, in which monies may not yet have been advanced, I now transmit a report of the Secretary of the Navy, accompanied by a report from the Board of Commissioners of the Navy, with documents which contain the information desired. James Monroe. February 2, 1818. Washington, February 6, 1818. To the House of Representatives of the United States. I transmit to the House of Representatives a report of the Secretary of State, in compliance with the resolution of said House requesting information respecting the ratification of the 14th article of the amendments to the Constitution of the United States. James Monroe. Washington, February 10, 1818. To the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States. As the House appropriated for the President of the United States will be finished this year, it is thought to merit the attention of the Congress in what manner it should be furnished and what measures ought to be adopted for the safekeeping of the furniture in future. All the public furniture, provided before 1814 having been destroyed with the public buildings in that year, and little afterwards procured, owing to the inadequacy of the appropriation, it has become necessary to provide almost every article requisite for such an establishment, whence the sum to be expended will be much greater than at any former period. The furniture in its kind and extent is thought to be an object not less deserving attention than the building for which it is intended. Both being national objects, each seems to have an equal claim to legislative sanction. The disbursement of the public money, too, ought, it is presumed, to be in like manner, provided for by law. The person who may happen to be placed by the suffrage of his fellow citizens in the high trust, having no personal interest in these concerns, should be exempted from undue responsibility respecting them. For a building so extensive, intended for a purpose exclusively national, in which in the furniture, provided for it a mingled regard is due to the simplicity and purity of our institutions and to the character of the people who are represented in it, the sum already appropriated has proved altogether inadequate. The present is therefore a proper time for Congress to take the subject into consideration, with a view to all the objects claiming attention, and to regulate it by law. In a knowledge of the furniture procured and the sum expended for it, a just estimate may be formed regarding the extent of the building of what will still be wanting to furnish the house. Many of the articles, being of a durable nature, may be handed down through a long series of service, and being of great value, such as plate, ought not to be left altogether and at all times to the care of servants alone. It seems to be advisable that a public agent should be charged with it during the occasional absences of the President, and have authority to transfer it from one President to another, and likewise to make reports of occasional deficiencies, as the basis in which further provisions should be made. It may also merit consideration, whether it may not be proper to commit the care of the public buildings, particularly the President's House and the Capitol, with the grounds belonging to them, including likewise the furniture of the latter, in a more special manner to a public agent. Hitherto the charge of this valuable property seems to have been connected with the structure of the buildings and committed to those employed in it. This guard will necessarily cease when the buildings are finished, at which time the interest in them will be proportionably augmented. It is presumed that this trust is, in a certain degree at least, incidental to the other duties of the superintendent of the public buildings, but it may merit consideration whether it will not be proper to charge him with it more explicitly, and to give him authority to employ one or more persons under him for these purposes. James Monroe, Washington, February 12, 1818. To the Senate and House of Representatives. I lay before the House of Representatives copies of two communications received at the Department of State from the Minister of Great Britain, and submit to their consideration the propriety of making such legislative provisions as may be necessary for a compliance with the representations contained in them. By the express terms of that compacted laws, when ratified by the two governments, to be in force for the term of 4 years from the day of its signature. The revocation of all the discriminating duties became, therefore, the obligation of both governments from that day, and it is conceived that every individual who has been required to pay, and who has paid, any of the extra duties revoked by the convention has a just and lawful claim upon the respective governments for its return. From various accidents it has happened that both here and in Great Britain the cessation of the extra duties has been fixed to commence at different times. It is desirable that Congress should pass an act providing for the return of all the extra duties incompatible with the terms of the convention which have been levied upon British vessels or merchandise after the 3rd of July, 1815. The British Parliament have already set the example of fixing that day for the cessation of the extra duties of export by their act of 30th of June last. And the Minister of the United States in London is instructed to require the extension of the same principle to all the extra duties levied in vessels and merchandise of the United States in the ports of Great Britain since that day. It is not doubted that the British government will comply with this requisition, and that the act suggested may be passed by Congress with full confidence that the reciprocal measure will receive the sanction of the British Parliament. James Monroe, Washington, February 23, 1818. To the Senate of the United States.
In compliance with a resolution of the Senate requesting me to cause to be laid before them a statement of all the arms and accoutrements which have been manufactured at the different armories of the United States, with the cost of each stand, and the number delivered to each state, respectively, under the Act for arming the whole body of militia, I now transmit a report from the Secretary of War, with the documents marked A, B, and C, which, together with a report to him from the Ordnance Department, contains the information required. James Monroe, Washington, February 23, 1818. To the Senate of the United States.
In compliance with the resolution of the Senate of the 19th of January, 1818, requesting information of measures which have been taken in pursuance of so much of the Act to authorize the appointment of a surveyor for lands in the northern part of the Mississippi Territory, passed the 3rd of March, 1817, as relates to the reservation of certain sections for the purpose of laying out and establishing towns thereon, I now transmit a report from the Secretary of the Treasury, which, with the letters and charts referred to in it, contains all the information which is desired. James Monroe, Washington, February 25, 1818.
to the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States. The commissioners of the two governments, under the fourth article of the Treaty of Ghent, having come to a decision upon the questions submitted to them, I lay before Congress copies of that decision, together with copies of the declaration signed and reported by the commissioners of this government. James Monroe. February 27, 1818. To the House of Representatives of the United States. I communicate herewith to the House of Representatives a copy of a letter from the Governor of the State of South Carolina to the Secretary of State, together with extracts from the journals of proceedings in both branches of the legislature of that Commonwealth, relative to a proposed amendment of the Constitution, which letter and extracts are connected with the subject of my communication to the House of the 6th instant. James Monroe. Washington, February 28, 1818. To the House of Representatives of the United States. I lay before the House a report from the Secretary of State, together with the papers relating to the claims of merchants of the United States upon the government of Naples, in conformity with the resolution of the House of the 30th January last. James Monroe. Washington, March 11, 1818. To the Senate of the United States.
In compliance with the resolution of the Senate requesting information respecting the requisitions that were made in the contractors between the 1st of June and the 24th of December, 1817, for deposits of provisions in advance at the several posts in the frontiers of Georgia and the adjoining territory, their conduct in compliance therewith, the amount of money advanced to be due, and the extent of his failure, with a copy of the articles of contract entered into with him, I now lay before the Senate a report from the Secretary of War, which, with the documents accompanying it, will afford the information desired. James Monroe. Washington, March 14, 1818. To the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States. In compliance with the resolution of the Senate of the 16th of December and of the House of Representatives of the 24th of February last, I lay before Congress a report of the Secretary of State, and the papers referred to in it, respecting a negotiation with the government of Spain, to explain fully the nature of the differences between the United States and Spain and the conduct of the parties, it has been found necessary to go back to an early epoch. The recent correspondence, with the documents accompanying it, will give a full view of the whole subject, and place the conduct of the United States in every stage and under every circumstance, for justice, moderation, and a firm adherence to their rights, in the high and inerrible ground which it has invariably sustained. James Monroe. Washington, March 16, 1818. To the Senate of the United States.
In compliance with the resolution of the Senate of the United States of the 31st of December last, requesting the President to cause to be laid before them a statement of the proceedings which may have been had under the Act of Congress passed on the 3rd of March, 1817, entitled An Act to Set Apart and Dispose of Certain Public Lands for the Encouragement and Cultivation of the Vine and Olive, I now transmit a report from the Secretary of the Treasury, containing all the information possessed by the executive relating to the proceedings under the said act. James Monroe. Washington, March 16, 1818. To the Senate of the United States.
In compliance with the resolution of the Senate of the United States of the 3rd of February last, requesting the President to cause to be laid before them a statement of the progress made under the Act to provide for surveying the coast of the United States, passed February 10, 1807, and any subsequent acts in the same subject, and the expenses incurred thereby,
I transmit a report from the Secretary of the Treasury containing the information required. James Monroe. March 19, 1818. To the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States. In the course of the last summer, a negotiation was commenced with the government of the Netherlands with a view to the revival and modification of the commercial treaty existing between the two countries, adapted to their present circumstances. The report from the Secretary of State which I now lay before Congress will show the obstacles which arose in the progress of the conferences between the respective plenipotentiaries, and which resulted in the agreement between them then to refer the subject to the consideration of their respective governments.
As the difficulties appear to be of a nature which may, perhaps, for the present, be more easily removed by reciprocal legislative regulations, formed in the spirit of amity and conciliation, than by conventional stipulations, Congress may think it advisable to leave the subsisting treaty in its present state, and to meet the liberal exemption from discriminating tonnage duties which has been conceded in the Netherlands to the vessels of the United States by a similar exemption to the vessels of the Netherlands which have arrived, or may hereafter arrive, in our ports, commencing from the time when the exemption was granted to the vessels of the United States. I would further recommend to the consideration of Congress the expediency of extending the benefit of the same regulation, to commence from the passage of the law, to the vessels of Russia, Hamburg, and Bremen, and of making it prospectively general in favor of every nation in whose ports the vessels of the United States are admitted in the same footing as their own. James Monroe. Washington, March 23, 1818. To the Senate of the United States. I lay before the Senate a report from the Secretary of the Navy, with the estimate of the expense which will be incurred by the establishment of two dockyards for repairing vessels of the largest size. James Monroe. Washington, March 25, 1818. To the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States. I now lay before Congress all the information in the possession of the executive respecting the war with the Seminoles, and the measures which it has been thought proper to adopt for the safety of our fellow citizens in the frontier exposed to their ravages. The enclosed documents show that the hostilities of this tribe were unprovoked, the offspring of a spirit long cherished and often manifested toward the United States, and that in the present instance it was extending itself to other tribes and daily assuming a more serious aspect. As soon as the nature and object of this combination were perceived, the Major General commanding the Southern Division of the Troops of the United States was ordered to the theater of action, charged with the management of the war and vested with the powers necessary to give it effect. The season of the year being unfavorable to active operations, and the recesses of the country affording shelter to these savages in case of retreat, may prevent a prompt termination of the war, but it may be fairly presumed that it will not be long before this tribe and its associates receive the punishment which they have provoked and justly merited. As almost the whole of this tribe inhabits the country within the limits of Florida, Spain was bound by the Treaty of 1795 to restrain them from committing hostilities against the United States. We have seen with regret that her government has altogether failed to fulfill this obligation, nor are we aware that it made any effort to that effect. When we consider her utter inability to check, even in the slightest degree, the movements of this tribe by her very small and incompetent force in Florida, we are not disposed to ascribe the failure to any other cause. The inability, however, of Spain to maintain her authority over the territory and Indians within her limits, and in consequence to fulfill the treaty, ought not to expose the United States to other and greater injuries.
When the authority of Spain ceases to exist there, the United States have a right to pursue their enemy in a principle of self-defense. In this instance, the right is more complete and obvious, because we shall perform only what Spain was bound to have performed herself. To the high obligations and privileges of this great and sacred right of self-defense will the movement of our troops be strictly confined. Orders have been given to the general in command not to enter Florida, unless it be in pursuit of the enemy, and in that case to respect the Spanish authority, wherever it is maintained, and he will be instructed to withdraw his forces from the province as soon as he shall have reduced that tribe to order, and secure our fellow citizens in that quarter by satisfactory arrangements against its unprovoked and savage hostilities in future. James Monroe, Washington, March 25, 1818. To the House of Representatives of the United States. In conformity with the resolution of the House of Representatives of the 5th of December last, I now transmit a report of the Secretary of State, with a copy of the documents which it is thought proper to communicate relating to the independence and political condition of the provinces of Spanish America. James Monroe, Washington, March 26, 1818. To the House of Representatives of the United States. I transmit to the House of Representatives, in compliance with their resolution of March 20th, such information not heretofore communicated, as is in the possession of the executive relating to the occupation of Amelia Island. If any doubt had before existed of the improper conduct of the persons who authorized and of those who were engaged in the invasion and previous occupancy of that island, of the unfriendly spirit toward the United States with which it was commenced and prosecuted, and of its injurious effect in their highest interests, particularly by its tendency to compromit them with foreign powers in all the unwarrantable acts of the adventurers, it is presumed that these documents would remove it. It appears by the letter of Mr. Bazis, agent of Commodore Ory, that the project of seizing the Floridas was formed and executed at a time when it was understood that Spain had resolved to cede them to the United States, and to prevent such cession from taking effect. The whole proceeding in every stage and circumstance was unlawful. The commission to General McGregor was granted at Philadelphia in direct violation of a positive law, and all the measures pursued under it by him in collecting his force and directing its movements were equally unlawful. With the conduct of these persons I have always been unwilling to connect any of the colonial governments, because I never could believe that they had given their sanction either to the project in its origin or to the measures which were pursued in the execution of it. These documents confirm the opinion which I have invariably entertained and expressed in their favor. James Monroe, Washington, March 28th. 1818. To the Senate of the United States. In compliance with the resolution of the Senate relative to the pensioners of the United States, the sum annually paid to each, and the states or territories in which said pensioners are respectively paid, I now transmit a report from the Secretary of War, which, with documents marked A and B, contains all the information required. James Monroe, April 6, 1818. To the Senate of the United States. An arrangement having been made and concluded between this government and that of Great Britain with respect to the naval armament of the two governments, respectively, in the lakes, I lay before the Senate a copy of the correspondence upon that subject, including the stipulations mutually agreed upon by the two parties. I submit it to the consideration of the Senate, whether this is such an arrangement, as the executive is competent to enter into by the powers vested in it by the Constitution, or is such an one, as requires the advice and consent of the Senate, and, in the latter case, for their advice and consent should it be approved. James Monroe, Washington, April 9, 1818. To the Senate of the United States. In compliance with the resolution of the Senate requesting me to cause to be laid before them a list of the names of the several agents of Indian affairs and of agents of Indian trading houses, with the pay and emolument of the agents, respectively, I now transmit a report from the Secretary of War, which contains the information required. James Monroe, April 10, 1818. To the Senate of the United States. In compliance with the resolution of the Senate respecting the supplies of the Northwestern Army, within certain periods therein specified, by contractors, commissaries, and agents, and the expense thereby incurred, I now transmit to them a report from the Secretary of War, which, with the documents accompanying it, will afford the information required. James Monroe, Washington, April 15, 1818. To the House of Representatives of the United States. In compliance with the resolution of the House of Representatives of the 10th instant, relative to the capture and imprisonment of certain persons, citizens of the United States, therein specifically mentioned, I now transmit a report from the Secretary of State, which, with the documents accompanying it, embraces the objects contemplated by the said resolution. James Monroe, Washington, April 20, 1818. To the Senate of the United States. I transmit to the Senate a copy of the rules, regulations, and instructions for the naval service of the United States, prepared by the Board of Navy Commissioners in obedience to an act of Congress passed 7th of February, 1815, entitled An Act to Alter and Amend the Several Acts for Establishing a Navy Department by Adding Thereto a Board of Commissioners. James Monroe. Proclamations. By the President of the United States of America. A Proclamation.
Whereas by an act of the Lieutenant Governor, Council, and Assembly of His Britannic Majesty's Province of Nova Scotia, passed in the year 1816, it was, among other things, enacted that from and after the first day of May of that year no plaster of Paris, otherwise called gypsum, which should be laid nor put on board any ship or vessel at any port or place within the limits of the said province to be transported from thence to any other port or place within or without the said limits, should, directly or indirectly, be laid nor landed or put on shore at any port or place in the United States of America eastward of Boston, in the state of Massachusetts, nor laid nor put on board any American ship, vessel, boat, or shallop of any description at any port or place eastward of Boston aforesaid, under the penalty of the forfeiture of every such ship or vessel from which any such plaster of Paris, or gypsum, should be laid in contrary to the provision of the said act, together with her bolts, tackle, apparel, and furniture, to be seized and prosecuted in the manner thereinafter mentioned, and whereas by an act of the Congress of the United States passed on the third day of March, 1817, it was enacted that from and after the fourth day of July then next no plaster of Paris the production of any country or its dependencies from which the vessels of the United States were not permitted to bring the same article should be imported into the United States in any foreign vessel, and that all plaster of Paris imported or attempted to be imported into the United States contrary to the true intent and meaning of the said act of Congress, and the vessel in which the same might be imported or attempted to be imported, together with the cargo, tackle, apparel, and furniture, should be forfeited to the United States and liable to be seized, prosecuted, and condemned in the manner therein prescribed, and whereas by the said act of Congress it was further enacted that the same should continue and be in force 5 years from January 31, 1817, provided, nevertheless, that, if any foreign nation or its dependencies which at the time of the passage of the said act of Congress had in force regulations in the subject of the trade in plaster of Paris prohibiting the exportation thereof to certain ports of the United States should discontinue such regulations, the President of the United States was thereby authorized to declare that fact by his proclamation, and the restrictions imposed by the said act of Congress should from the date of such proclamation cease and be discontinued in relation to the nation or its dependencies discontinuing such regulations, and whereas an act of the Lieutenant Governor, Council, and Assembly of His Britannic Majesty's Province of Nova Scotia, repealing the above-mentioned act of the said province, passed in the year 1816, has been officially communicated by his said Majesty's Envoy Extraordinary and Minister Plenipotentiary to this government, and whereas by the said repealing act of the said province of Nova Scotia, one of the dependencies of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, the regulations at the time of the passage of the said Act of Congress in force in the said province in the subject of the trade in plaster of Paris, prohibiting the exportation thereof to certain ports of the United States, have been and are discontinued. Now, therefore, I, James Monroe, President of the United States of America, do by this my proclamation declare that fact, and that the restrictions imposed by the said Act of Congress do from the date hereof cease and are discontinued in relation to His Britannic Majesty's said province of Nova Scotia, given under my hand, at the city of Washington, this 23rd day of April, A.D. 1818, and in the 42nd year of the independence of the United States. James Monroe. By the President, John Quincy Adams, Secretary of State. By the President of the United States of America. A Proclamation.
Whereas an arrangement was entered into at the city of Washington in the month of April, A.D. 1817, between Richard Rush, Esquire, at that time acting as Secretary for the Department of State of the United States, for and in behalf of the Government of the United States, and the Right Honorable Charles Bagot, His Britannic Majesty's Envoy Extraordinary and Minister Plenipotentiary, for and in behalf of His Britannic Majesty, which arrangement is in the words following, to wit, a naval force to be maintained upon the American lakes by His Majesty and the Government of the United States shall henceforth be confined to the following vessels in each side, that is, in Lake Ontario, to one vessel not exceeding 100 tons burden and armed with 1 18-pound cannon. In the upper lakes, to two vessels not exceeding like burden each and armed with like force. In the waters of Lake Champlain, to one vessel not exceeding like burden and armed with like force. All other armed vessels on these lakes shall be forthwith dismantled, and no other vessels of war shall be there built or armed. If either party should hereafter be desirous of annulling this stipulation, and should give notice to that effect to the other party, it shall cease to be binding after the expiration of 6 months from the date of such notice. The naval force so to be limited shall be restricted to such services, as will in no respect interfere with the proper duties of the armed vessels of the other party. And whereas the Senate of the United States have approved of the said arrangement and recommended that it should be carried into effect, the same having also received the sanction of His Royal Highness the Prince Regent, acting in the name and in the behalf of His Britannic Majesty. Now, therefore, I, James Monroe, President of the United States, Do by this my proclamation make known and declare that the arrangement aforesaid and every stipulation thereof has been duly entered into, concluded, and confirmed, and is of full force and effect. Given under my hand, at the city of Washington, this 28th day of April, A.D. 1818, and of the independence of the United States the 42nd. James Monroe. By the President, John Quincy Adams, Secretary of State. By the President of the United States of America. A Proclamation. Whereas it appears by a proclamation of the Lieutenant Governor of His Britannic Majesty's Province of New Brunswick bearing date the 10th day of April last, and officially communicated by His Envoy Extraordinary and Minister Plenipotentiary residing in the United States to this government, that the regulations in the subject of the trade in plaster of Paris, prohibiting the exportation thereof to certain ports of the United States, which were in force in the said province at the time of the enactment of the Act of the Congress of the United States entitled an act to regulate the trade in plaster of Paris, passed on the 3rd day of March, 1817, have been and are discontinued. Now, therefore, I, James Monroe, President of the United States, do hereby declare that fact, and that the restrictions imposed by the said Act of Congress shall from the date hereof cease and be discontinued in relation to the said province of New Brunswick. Given under my hand, at the city of Washington, this 4th day of July, A.D. 1818, and in the 43rd year of the independence of the United States. James Monroe. By the President, John Quincy Adams, Secretary of State. By the President of the United States of America. A Proclamation. Whereas by an act of the Congress of the United States of the 3rd of March, 1815, so much of the several acts imposing duties on the ships and vessels and in goods, wares, and merchandise imported into the United States, has imposed a discriminating duty of tonnage between foreign vessels and vessels of the United States and between goods imported into the United States in foreign vessels and vessels of the United States were repealed so far, as the same respected the produce or manufacture of the nation to which such foreign ship or vessel might belong, such repeal to take effect in favor of any foreign nation, whenever the President of the United States should be satisfied that the discriminating or countervailing duties of such foreign nation so far, as they operate to the disadvantage of the United States have been abolished, and whereas satisfactory proof has been received by me from the burgomasters and senators of the free and ancetic city of Bremen that from and after the 12th day of May, 1815, all discriminating or countervailing duties of the said city so far, as they operated to the disadvantage of the United States have been and are abolished. Now, therefore, I, James Monroe, President of the United States of America, do hereby declare and proclaim that so much of the several acts imposing duties on the tonnage of ships and vessels and in goods, wares, and merchandise imported into the United States, has imposed a discriminating duty of tonnage between vessels of the free and ancetic city of Bremen and vessels of the United States and between goods imported into the United States in vessels of Bremen and vessels of the United States are repealed so far as the same respect the produce or manufacture of the said free ancetic city of Bremen. Given under my hand, at the city of Washington, this 24th day of July, A.D. 1818, and the 43rd year of the independence of the United States. James Monroe. By the President, John Quincy Adams, Secretary of State. By the President of the United States of America. A Proclamation. Whereas by an act of the Congress of the United States of the 3rd of March,
1815, so much of the several acts imposing duties on the ships and vessels and in goods, wares, and merchandise imported into the United States, has imposed a discriminating duty of tonnage between foreign vessels and vessels of the United States and between goods imported into the United States in foreign vessels and vessels of the United States were repealed so far, as the same respected the produce or manufacture of the nation to which such foreign ship or vessel might belong, such repeal to take effect in favor of any foreign nation, whenever the President of the United States should be satisfied that the discriminating or countervailing duties of such foreign nation so far, as they operate to the disadvantage of the United States have been abolished, and whereas satisfactory proof has been received by me from the burgomasters and senators of the free and hanseatic city of Hamburg that from and after the 14th day of November, 1815, all discriminating and countervailing duties of the said city so far, as they operated to the disadvantage of the United States have been and are abolished. Now, therefore, I, James Monroe, President of the United States of America, do hereby declare and proclaim that so much of the several acts imposing duties on the tonnage of ships and vessels and in goods, wares, and merchandise imported into the United States, has imposed a discriminating duty of tonnage between vessels of the free and hanseatic city of Hamburg and vessels of the United States and between goods imported into the United States in vessels of Hamburg and vessels of the United States are repealed so far as the same respect the produce or manufacture of the said free hanseatic city of Hamburg, given under my hand, at the city of Washington, this first day of August, A.D. 1818, and the 43rd year of the independence of the United States. James Monroe. By the President, John Quincy Adams, Secretary of State. Second Annual Message. November 16, 1818. Fellow citizens of the Senate and of the House of Representatives. The auspicious circumstances under which you will commence the duties of the present session will lighten the burdens inseparable from the high trust committed to you. The fruits of the earth have been unusually abundant, commerce has flourished, the revenue has exceeded the most favorable anticipation, and peace and amity are preserved with foreign nations in conditions just and inerrible to our country. For these inestimable blessings we cannot but be grateful to that providence which watches over the destiny of nations. As the term limited for the operation of the commercial convention with Great Britain will expire early in the month of July next, and it was deemed important that there should be no interval during which that portion of our commerce which was provided for by that convention should not be regulated, either by arrangement between the two governments or by the authority of Congress, the Minister of the United States at London was instructed early in the last summer to invite the attention of the British government to the subject, with a view to that object. He was instructed to propose also that the negotiation which it was wished to open might extend to the general commerce of the two countries, and to every other interest and unsettled difference between them, particularly those relating to impressment, the fisheries, and boundaries, in the hope that an arrangement might be made in principles of reciprocal advantage which might comprehend and provide in a satisfactory manner for all these high concerns. I have the satisfaction to state that the proposal was received by the British government in the spirit which prompted it, and that a negotiation has been opened at London embracing all these objects. In full consideration of the great extent and magnitude of the trust, it was thought proper to commit it to not less than 12 of our distinguished citizens,
and in consequence the envoy extraordinary and minister plenipotentiary of the United States at Paris has been associated with our envoy extraordinary and minister plenipotentiary at London, to both of whom corresponding instructions have been given, and they are now engaged in the discharge of its duties. It is proper to add that to prevent any inconvenience resulting from the delay incident to a negotiation on so many important subjects, it was agreed before entering on it that the existing convention should be continued for a term not less than 8 years. Our relations with Spain remain nearly in the state in which they were at the close of the last session. The Convention of 1802, providing for the adjustment of a certain portion of the claims of our citizens for injuries sustained by spoliation, and so long suspended by the Spanish government, has at length been ratified by it, but no arrangement has yet been made for the payment of another portion of like claims, not less extensive or well-founded, or for other classes of claims, or for the settlement of boundaries. These subjects have again been brought under consideration in both countries, but no agreement has been entered into respecting them. In the meantime, events have occurred which clearly prove the ill effect of the policy which that government has so long pursued in the friendly relations of the two countries, which it is presumed is at least of as much importance to Spain as to the United States to maintain. A state of things has existed in the Floridas, the tendency of which has been obvious to all who have paid the slightest attention to the progress of affairs in that quarter. Throughout the whole of those provinces to which the Spanish title extends, the government of Spain has scarcely been felt. Its authority has been confined almost exclusively to the walls of Pensacola and St. Augustine, within which only small garrisons have been maintained. Adventurers from every country, fugitives from justice, and absconding slaves have found an asylum there. Several tribes of Indians, strong in the number of their warriors, remarkable for their ferocity, and whose settlements extend to our limits, inhabit those provinces. These different hordes of people, connected together, disregarding on the one side the authority of Spain, and protected in the other by an imaginary line which separates Florida from the United States, have violated our laws prohibiting the introduction of slaves, have practiced various frauds in our revenue, and committed every kind of outrage in our peaceable citizens which their proximity to us enabled them to perpetrate. The invasion of Amelia Island last year by a small band of adventurers, not exceeding 150 in number, who wrested it from the inconsiderable Spanish force stationed there, and held it several months, during which a single feeble effort only was made to recover it, which failed, clearly proves how completely extinct the Spanish authority had become, as the conduct of those adventurers, while in possession of the island, as distinctly shows the pernicious purposes for which their combination had been formed. This country had, in fact, become the theater of every species of lawless adventure. With little population of its own, the Spanish authority almost extinct, and the colonial governments in a state of revolution, having no pretension to it, and sufficiently employed in their own concerns, it was in a great measure derelict, and the object of cupidity to every adventurer. A system of buccaneering was rapidly organizing over it which menaced in its consequences the lawful commerce of every nation, and particularly of the United States, while it presented a temptation to every people, in whose seduction its success principally depended. In regard to the United States, the pernicious effect of this unlawful combination was not confined to the ocean. The Indian tribes have constituted the effective force in Florida.
With these tribes these adventurers had formed at an early period a connection with a view to avail themselves of that force to promote their own projects of accumulation and aggrandizement. It is to the interference of some of these adventurers, in misrepresenting the claims and titles of the Indians to land and in practicing on their savage propensities, that the Seminole War is principally to be traced. Men who thus connect themselves with savage communities and stimulate them to war, which is always attended in their part with acts of barbarity the most shocking, deserve to be viewed in a worse light than the savages. They would certainly have no claim to an immunity from the punishment which, according to the rules of warfare practiced by the savages, might justly be inflicted in the savages themselves. If the embarrassments of Spain prevented her from making an indemnity to our citizens for so long a time from her treasury for their losses by spoliation and otherwise, it was always in her power to have provided it by the cession of this territory. Of this her government has been repeatedly apprised, and the cession was the more to have been anticipated, as Spain must have known that in ceding it she would in effect cede what had become of little value to her, and would likewise relieve herself from the important obligation secured by the Treaty of 1795 and all other compromitments respecting it. If the United States, from consideration of these embarrassments, declined pressing their claims in a spirit of hostility, the motive ought at least to have been duly appreciated by the government of Spain. It is well known to her government that other powers have made to the United States an indemnity for like losses sustained by their citizens at the same epoch. There is nevertheless a limit beyond which the spirit of amity and forbearance can in no instance be justified. If it was proper to rely on amicable negotiation for an indemnity for losses, it would not have been so to have permitted the inability of Spain to fulfill her engagements and to sustain her authority in the Floridas to be perverted by foreign adventurers and savages to purposes so destructive to the lives of our fellow citizens and the highest interests of the United States. The right of self-defense never ceases. It is among the most sacred, and alike necessary to nations and to individuals, and whether the attack be made by Spain herself or by those who abuse her power, its obligation is not the less strong. The invaders of Amelia Island had assumed a popular and respected title under which they might approach and wound us. As their object was distinctly seen, and the duty imposed in the executive by an existing law was profoundly felt, that mask was not permitted to protect them. It was thought incumbent on the United States to suppress the establishment, and it was accordingly done. The combination in Florida for the unlawful purposes stated, the acts perpetrated by that combination, and, above all, the incitement of the Indians to massacre our fellow citizens of every age and of both sexes, merited a like treatment and received it. In pursuing these savages to an imaginary line in the woods it would have been the height of folly to have suffered that line to protect them. Had that been done the war could never cease. Even if the territory had been exclusively that of Spain and her power complete over it, we had a right by the law of nations to follow the enemy in it and to subdue him there. But the territory belonged, in a certain sense at least, to the savage enemy who inhabited it. The power of Spain had ceased to exist over it, and protection was sought under her title by those who had committed in our citizens hostilities which she was bound by treaty to have prevented, but had not the power to prevent. To have stopped at that line would have given new encouragement to these savages and new vigor to the whole combination existing there in the prosecution of all its pernicious purposes. In suppressing the establishment at Amelia Island no unfriendliness was manifested towards Spain, because the post was taken from a force which had wrested it from her. The measure, it is true, was not adopted in concert with the Spanish government or those in authority under it, because in transactions connected with the war in which Spain and the colonies are engaged, it was thought proper in doing justice to the United States to maintain a strict impartiality toward both the belligerent parties without consulting or acting in concert with either. It gives me pleasure to state that the governments of Buenos Aires and Venezuela, whose names were assumed, have explicitly disclaimed all participation in those measures, and even the knowledge of them until communicated by this government, and have also expressed their satisfaction that a course of proceedings had been suppressed which, if justly imputable to them, would dishonor their cause. In authorizing Major General Jackson to enter Florida in pursuit of the Seminoles, care was taken not to encroach on the rights of Spain. I regret to have to add that in executing this order, facts were disclosed respecting the conduct of the officers of Spain in authority there in encouraging the war, furnishing munitions of war and other supplies to carry it on, and in other acts not less marked which evinced their participation in the hostile purposes of that combination and justified the confidence with which it inspired the savages that by those officers they would be protected. A conduct so incompatible with the friendly relations existing between the two countries, particularly with the positive obligation of the fifth article of the Treaty of 1795, by which Spain was bound to restrain, even by force, those savages from acts of hostility against the United States, could not fail to excite surprise. The commanding general was convinced that he should fail in his object, that he should, in effect, accomplish nothing, if he did not deprive those savages of the resource in which they had calculated and of the protection in which they had relied in making the war. As all the documents relating to this occurrence will be laid before Congress, it is not necessary to enter into further detail respecting it. Although the reasons which induced Major General Jackson to take these posts were duly appreciated, there was nevertheless no hesitation in deciding on the course which it became the government to pursue. As there was reason to believe that the commanders of these posts had violated their instructions, there was no disposition to impute to their government a conduct so unprovoked and hostile. An order was in consequence issued to the general in command there to deliver the posts, Pensacola, unconditionally to any person duly authorized to receive it, and St. Mark's, which is in the heart of the Indian country, in the arrival of a competent force to defend it against those savages and their associates. In entering Florida to suppress this combination, no idea was entertained of hostility to Spain, and however justifiable the commanding general was, in consequence of the misconduct of the Spanish officers, in entering St. Mark's and Pensacola to terminate it by proving to the savages and their associates that they should not be protected even there, yet the amicable relations existing between the United States and Spain could not be altered by that act alone. By ordering the restitution of the posts, those relations were preserved. To a change of them, the power of the executive is deemed incompetent, it is vested in Congress only. By this measure, so promptly taken, due respect was shown to the government of Spain. The misconduct of her officers has not been imputed to her. She was enabled to review with candor her relations with the United States and her own situation, particularly in respect to the territory in question, with the dangers inseparable from it, and regarding the losses we have sustained, for which indemnity has been so long withheld, and the injuries we have suffered through that territory, and her means of redress, she was likewise enabled to take with honor the course best calculated to do justice to the United States and to promote her own welfare.
copies of the instructions to the commanding general, of his correspondence with the Secretary of War, explaining his motives and justifying his conduct, with a copy of the proceedings of the courts-martial in the trial of Arbuthnot and Ambristie, and of the correspondence between the Secretary of State and the Minister Plenipotentiary of Spain via this government, and of the Minister Plenipotentiary of the United States at Madrid with the government of Spain, will be laid before Congress. The civil war which has so long prevailed between Spain and the provinces in South America still continues, without any prospect of its speedy termination. The information respecting the condition of those countries which has been collected by the commissioners recently returned from thence will be laid before Congress in copies of their reports, with such other information as has been received from other agents of the United States. It appears from these communications that the government at Buenos Aires declared itself independent in July, 1816, having previously exercised the power of an independent government, or in the name of the King of Spain, from the year 1810, that the Banda Oriental, Entre Rios, and Paraguay, with the city of Santa Fe, all of which are also independent, are unconnected with the present government of Buenos Aires, that Chile has declared itself independent and is closely connected with Buenos Aires, that Venezuela has also declared itself independent, and now maintains the conflict with various success, and that the remaining parts of South America, except Montevideo and such other portions of the eastern bank of the La Plata, as are held by Portugal, are still in the possession of Spain or in a certain degree under her influence. By a circular note addressed by the ministers of Spain to the Allied powers, with whom they are respectively accredited, it appears that the Allies have undertaken to mediate between Spain and the South American provinces, and that the manner and extent of their interposition would be settled by a Congress which was to have met at Aix-la-Chapelle in September last. From the general policy and course of proceeding observed by the Allied powers in regard to this contest, it is inferred that they will confine their interposition to the expression of their sentiments, abstaining from the application of force. I state this impression that force will not be applied with the greater satisfaction, because it is a course more consistent with justice and likewise authorizes a hope that the calamities of the war will be confined to the parties only, and will be of shorter duration. From the view taken of this subject, founded in all the information that we have been able to obtain, there is good cause to be satisfied with the course heretofore pursued by the United States in regard to this contest, and to conclude that it is proper to adhere to it, especially in the present state of affairs. I have great satisfaction in stating that our relations with France, Russia, and other powers continue on the most friendly basis. In our domestic concerns we have ample cause of satisfaction. The receipts into the Treasury during the three first quarters of the year have exceeded $70 million. After satisfying all the demands which have been made under existing appropriations, including the final extinction of the old 6% stock and the redemption of a moiety of the Louisiana debt, it is estimated that there will remain in the Treasury on the first day of January next more than $2 million. It is ascertained that the gross revenue which has accrued from the customs during the same period amounts to $21 million, and that the revenue of the whole year may be estimated at not less than $26 million. The sale of the public lands during the year has also greatly exceeded, both in quantity and price, that of any former year, and there is just reason to expect a progressive improvement in that source of revenue. It is gratifying to know that, although the annual expenditure has been increased by the act of the last session of Congress providing for revolutionary pensions to an amount about equal to the proceeds of the internal duties which were then repealed, the revenue for the ensuing year will be proportionally augmented, and that whilst the public expenditure will probably remain stationary, each successive year will add to the national resources by the ordinary increase in our population and by the gradual development of our latent sources of national prosperity. The strict execution of the revenue laws, resulting principally from the salutary provisions of the Act of the 20th of April last amending the several collection laws, has, it is presumed, secured to domestic manufacturers all the relief that can be derived from the duties which have been imposed upon foreign merchandise for their protection. Under the influence of this relief, several branches of this important national interest have assumed greater activity, and although it is hoped that others will gradually revive and ultimately triumph over every obstacle, yet the expediency of granting further protection is submitted to your consideration. The measures of defense authorized by existing laws have been pursued with the zeal and activity due to so important an object, and with all the dispatch practicable in so extensive and great an undertaking. The survey of our maritime and inland frontiers has been continued, and at the points where it was decided to erect fortifications, the work has been commenced, and in some instances considerable progress has been made. In compliance with resolutions of the last session, the Board of Commissioners were directed to examine in a particular manner the parts of the coast herein designated and to report their opinion of the most suitable sites for two naval depots. This work is in a train of execution. The opinion of the Board in this subject, with the plan of all the works necessary to a general system of defense so far as it has been formed, will be laid before Congress in a report from the proper department as soon as it can be prepared. In conformity with the appropriations of the last session, treaties have been formed with the Quapaw tribe of Indians inhabiting the country in the Arkansas, and with the Great and Little Osages north of the White River, with the tribes in the state of Indiana, with the several tribes within the state of Ohio and the Michigan Territory, and with the Chickasaws, by which very extensive cessions of territory have been made to the United States. Negotiations are now depending with the tribes in the Illinois Territory and with the Choctaws, by which it is expected that other extensive cessions will be made. I take great interest in stating that the cessions already made, which are considered so important to the United States, have been obtained in conditions very satisfactory to the Indians. With a view to the security of our inland frontiers, it has been thought expedient to establish strong posts at the mouth of Yellowstone River and at the Mandan Village in the Missouri, and at the mouth of St. Peter's in the Mississippi, at no great distance from our northern boundaries. It can hardly be presumed, while such posts are maintained in the rear of the Indian tribes, that they will venture to attack our peaceable inhabitants. A strong hope is entertained that this measure will likewise be productive of much good to the tribes themselves, especially in promoting the great object of their civilization. Experience has clearly demonstrated that independent savage communities cannot long exist within the limits of a civilized population. The progress of the latter has almost invariably terminated in the extinction of the former, especially of the tribes belonging to our portion of this hemisphere, among whom loftiness of sentiment and gallantry in action have been conspicuous. To civilize them, and even to prevent their extinction, it seems to be indispensable that their independence, as communities, should cease, and that the control of the United States over them should be complete and undisputed.
The hunter state will then be more easily abandoned, and recourse will be had to the acquisition and culture of land and to other pursuits tending to dissolve the ties which connect them together, as a savage community, and to give a new character to every individual. I present this subject to the consideration of Congress on the presumption that it may be found expedient and practicable to adopt some benevolent provisions, having these objects in view, relative to the tribes within our settlements. It has been necessary during the present year to maintain a strong naval force in the Mediterranean and in the Gulf of Mexico, and to send some public ships along the southern coast and to the Pacific Ocean. By these means, amicable relations with the Barbary powers have been preserved, our commerce has been protected, and our rights respected. The augmentation of our navy is advancing with a steady progress toward the limit contemplated by law. I communicate with great satisfaction the accession of another state, Illinois, to our Union, because I perceive from the proof afforded by the additions already made the regular progress and sure consummation of a policy of which history affords no example, and of which the good effect cannot be too highly estimated. By extending our government in the principles of our Constitution over the vast territory within our limits, in the lakes and the Mississippi and its numerous streams, new life and vigor are infused into every part of our system. By increasing the number of the states, the confidence of the state governments in their own security is increased and their jealousy of the national government proportionally diminished. The impracticability of one consolidated government for this great and growing nation will be more apparent and will be universally admitted. Incapable of exercising local authority except for general purposes, the general government will no longer be dreaded. In those cases of a local nature and for all the great purposes for which it was instituted, its authority will be cherished. Each government will acquire new force and a greater freedom of action within its proper sphere. Other inestimable advantages will follow. Our produce will be augmented to an incalculable amount in articles of the greatest value for domestic use and foreign commerce. Our navigation will in like degree be increased, and as the shipping of the Atlantic states will be employed in the transportation of the vast produce of the Western country, even those parts of the United States which are most remote from each other will be further bound together by the strongest ties which mutual interest can create. The situation of this district, it is thought, requires the attention of Congress. By the Constitution, the power of legislation is exclusively vested in the Congress of the United States. In the exercise of this power, in which the people have no participation, Congress legislate in all cases directly in the local concerns of the district. As this is a departure, for a special purpose, from the general principles of our system, it may merit consideration whether an arrangement better adapted to the principles of our government and to the particular interests of the people may not be devised which will neither infringe the Constitution nor affect the object which the provision in question was intended to secure. The growing population, already considerable, and the increasing business of the district, which it is believed already interferes with the deliberations of Congress in great national concerns, furnish additional motives for recommending this subject to your consideration. When we view the great blessings with which our country has been favored, those which we now enjoy, and the means which we possess of handing them down unimpaired to our latest posterity, our attention is irresistibly drawn to the source from whence they flow. Let us, then, unite in offering our most grateful acknowledgments for these blessings to the divine author of all good. James Monroe. Special Messages. November 30th, 1818. to the Senate of the United States.
I lay before the Senate, for their advice and consent, the several treaties which have recently been made with the Chickasaws, the Quapaws, the Wyandot, Seneca, Delaware, Shawnees, Potawatamis, Ottawas, and Chippewas, the Peoria, Kaskaskias, Michigamia, Cahokia, and Tamarois, the Great and Little Osages, the Wais, Potawatamis, Delaware and Miami, the Wyandot, and the four Shawnees tribes of Indians.
By reference to the Journal of the Commissioners, it appears that George and Levi Colbert have bargained and sold to the United States the reservations made to them by the Treaty of September, 1816, and that a deed of trust of the same has been made by them to James Jackson, of Nashville. I would therefore suggest, in case the Chickasaw Treaty be approved by the Senate, the propriety of providing by law for the payment of the sum stipulated to be given to them for their reservations. James Monroe. December 2, 1818. To the Senate of the United States. I transmit to the Senate copies of such of the documents referred to in the message of the 17th of last month, as have been prepared since that period. They contain a copy of the reports of Mr. Rubney and Mr. Graham, two of the commissioners to South America, who returned first from the mission, and of the papers connected with those reports. They also present a full view of the operations of our troops employed in the Seminole War in Florida. It would have been gratifying to me to have communicated with the message all the documents referred to in it. But as two of our commissioners from South America made their reports a few days only before the meeting of Congress and the third in the day of its meeting, it was impossible to transmit at that time more than one copy of the two reports first made. The residue of the documents will be communicated as soon as they are prepared. James Monroe. Washington, December 2, 1818. To the Senate of the United States.
In compliance with the resolution of the Senate of 25th of last month, requesting to be furnished with such information as may be possessed by the executive touching the execution of so much of the first article of the late Treaty of Peace and Amity between His Britannic Majesty and the United States, as relates to the restitution of slaves, and which has not heretofore been communicated, I lay before the Senate a report made by the Secretary of State on the first instant in relation to that subject.
James Monroe. December 2, 1818. To the House of Representatives of the United States. I transmit to the House of Representatives copies of such documents referred to in the message of the 17th ultimo, as have been prepared since that period. They present a full view of the operations of our troops employed in the Seminole War who entered Florida. The residue of the documents, which are very voluminous, will be transmitted as soon as they can be prepared.
James Monroe. December 12, 1818. To the House of Representatives of the United States.
In compliance with the resolution of the House of Representatives of the 10th instant, I transmit a report of the Secretary of War, with copies of the correspondence between the Governor of Georgia and Major General Andrew Jackson in the subject of the arrest of Captain Abed Wright.
James Monroe. December 29, 1818. To the Senate of the United States.
I lay before the Senate, for their consideration, a convention, signed at London on the 20th of October last, between the United States and Great Britain, together with the documents showing the course and progress of the negotiation. I have to request that these documents, which are original, may be returned when the Senate shall have acted in the convention.
James Monroe. December 31st, 1818.
To the House of Representatives of the United States.
In compliance with the resolution of the House of Representatives of the 24th instant, requesting me to lay before it copies of the correspondence, if any, between the Department of War and the Governor of Georgia, in answer to the letter of the latter to the former dated in the 1st of June of the present year, communicated to the House in the 12th instant, and also the correspondence, if any, between the Department of War and General Andrew Jackson, in answer to the letter of the latter of the date the 7th of May, 1818. Also communicated to the House in the 12th instant, I transmit a report from the Secretary of War, with a copy of an extract of a letter from Major Van Deventer, Chief Clerk in the Department of War, in reply to General Jackson's letter of the 7th of May, 1818. James Monroe, December 31, 1818. To the House of Representatives of the United States. In compliance with the resolution of the House of Representatives of the 7th instant, requesting me to lay before it the proceedings which have been had under the act entitled An Act for the Gradual Increase of the Navy of the United States, specifying the number of ships which have been put on the stocks, and of what class, and the quantity and kind of materials which have been procured in compliance with the provisions of said act, and also the sums of money which have been paid out of the fund created by the said act, and for what objects, and likewise, the contracts which have been entered into in execution of said act in which monies may not yet have been advanced, I transmit a report from the Acting Secretary of the Navy, together with a communication from the Board of Navy Commissioners, which, with the documents accompanying it, comprehends all the information required by the House of Representatives. James Monroe.